Welcome to Money, Markets and Masterminds, a Citywire South Africa podcast that delves into the intricate world of finance, investment and strategic decision making. If you're a fund selector or an independent financial advisor looking for insights, analysis and expert opinions to enhance your perspective, you're in the right place here with me, editor Ruan Uester. Today is our first episode of a new underlying series in partnership with Morningstar South Africa and their head of investment, Sean Neertling, who was on my show not too long ago. The series is aptly called Mind Over Markets with Morningstar and will provide the latest insights on monthly investment trends. So for the foreseeable future, the first Monday of every month, we will be exploring key market developments and dissecting economic indicators, which will cover everything from equities and fixed income to commodities and alternative investment. So let's get straight to it. Welcome back, Sean.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me on.
U.S. equities have continued to dominate global markets since the world emerged from the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020 and have been supported by exceptional performance by American tech companies, the so-called Magnificent Seven, leading valuations to all-time highs. According to Morningstar data, the S&P 500 returned 29.8% over the 12 months to end March 2024, and the Nasdaq delivered 39.2% over the same period. In short, if you had exposure to U.S. equities, especially listed tech stocks, you would have been in a very fortunate position today. Sean, it seems that NVIDIA continues to be the standout, with the company maintaining its competitive edge in generative AI. But we are starting to see some divergence in the performance of U.S. tech companies. Given the mixed earnings reports and the unclear path of interest rates in the U.S., what performance indicators should investors focus on to navigate this potential fork in the road for American tech companies?
Yeah, Ruan, I think that's the question on most investors' minds at this point in time. So I think there's a few things to really keep in mind here. I think the first is market concentration. So when you talk about the market today, a large part of performance largely comes from the small grouping of companies, which is actually really odd. So you've got this massive global investment universe, and then these seven companies being, you know, overly influential in terms of the so-called Magnificent Seven. So that has to be somewhat concerning. I think historically, drawdowns and sell-offs from these elevated concentration levels, if you go back to the 1970s and even the early 2000s, they've been especially severe. So drawdowns in the order of around 40%. So collectively, this grouping of U.S. AI, U.S. listed tech stocks, NVIDIA, Meta, Alphabet, Amazon, Apple, I think it's Microsoft and Tesla as well. You know, collectively, these companies have market caps which are greater than the largest economies and countries in the world. Which is quite astounding if you just think about, again, how well-positioned those economies are. So a really difficult and a really concerning market environment that we're in at the moment. I think the second thing you want to pay attention to here is just what's driving these valuations. So currently, what we're seeing is that valuations largely being driven by a combination of what we would see as especially lofty growth expectations and what we'd see as market sentiment. So with a short-term focus on company and macro news, and that's being too prominent of a role. Again, if we look at the magnitude of price changes, you know, after quarterly earnings numbers are disseminated, there is a large element here of investors trying to time the market. And that really ends well for investors. So for us, I think we continue to pay attention to company fundamentals. And we are especially mindful of this, you know, big disconnect between the prices of these companies and where they're trading relative to things like the quality of earnings, margin sustainability, and what we would consider to be fair multiples.
Sean, do you agree with Warren Buffett's view that the AI-driven rally in U.S. equities, particularly in the tech sector, has been overextended? And what signs should investors look for to assess if this market tide is indeed going out?
Well, I think the first thing I'd say that I'd need to be really brave or foolish to disagree with Warren Buffett. So I think I generally agree with his views. Particularly around the understandability and implications of AI, you know, potentially being a lot more clouded than what the market appears to be forecasting or pricing in. So I think some of these companies, you know, are outstanding businesses, but they look quite fully priced. maybe with a few exceptions. So I do think that the tide has turned on the collective grouping, the so-called Magnificent Seven. And what we are seeing is more discernment from investors in terms of accessing, let's say, that pure play AI or artificial intelligence. And there it does appear, for example, NVIDIA is the clear market leader. It's an outstanding business with very well-developed competitive advantages in technologies that we do think will change the way that people live and work. But again, at the current price, it's not a great investment. And it does seem, somewhat overextended with investors paying, again, potentially too high a price for a future that maybe hasn't been created yet. Again, if you drill down, what's strange about the Warren Buffett comment, it may seem strange, is if you drill down into that Berkshire portfolio, it's interesting that it's quite heavily invested in Apple. It's one of the top positions, which almost contradicts some of, I suppose, the Buffett views. But I think here, again, it's important to keep in mind they've actually been trimming that position. And that investment case actually has less to do with tech or IT or AI. And it's actually more centered on fundamentals. If you look at things like market share, network effects, and probably things like switching costs. So again, I suppose to answer your question, if we zoom in on the current direction of travel and consider, I suppose, divergence in performance, it does appear the tide is starting to go out on some of these tech companies. And again, we've seen parts of that basket break up. So Tesla being especially volatile, Meta and Apple trading mostly sideways. So again, I do think we're starting to see the tide starting to shift on this collective basket of artificial intelligence being lumped together.
Sean, some of the data show how emerging markets have outperformed the US since the start of the second quarter of 2024, after lagging in the first quarter of this year. It also shows the dispersion in emerging market performance, with some countries like China, India, Turkey, and South Africa doing well, but others like Brazil and Korea are lagging. If we look at the underlying global trends, where exactly is the money going and why? And can we expect a shift to part of the world that are maybe off the radar?
Yeah, Luan, that's a great question. And there's a few things there. So I'll try to unpack it as best as I can. So if we look at how markets have performed, say, let's say since the end of March, we can see emerging markets catching a bit of a bid and attracting some capital. Not significantly so, but as rate hike or rate cut expectations gets pushed out, we are seeing some money flowing into those markets. And from a valuation perspective, like you said, those emerging markets are particularly cheap. We've seen China and South Africa start the quarter really well, both in local currency and in dollars. Turkey and India and Africa have actually been performing really well for a long time. And then we have some laggards in terms of Brazil and Korea that, again, probably last year performed really well, but probably lagging their peers, I suppose, in the first couple of months of this year. So I think, if we turn to other parts of the emerging markets or developed market complex, I think if you look at the UK, it's done particularly well. Again, it's an undervalued market where you're buying, things which are relatively defensive, things like defensive consumer staples, the Diageo and Bats. And you're also getting some energy exposure, which I actually think is fairly well priced to things like Shell and BP. So we actually think the UK is still quite cheap. And on a normalized basis, we're quite positive on the investment case for the UK and European energy. I think the general consensus is that the UK is, at this point in time, US tech is particularly crowded. The observed trends that we are seeing are largely consistent with this over the last few months. So what we are observing is this, I suppose, flow of capital out of what we would see as large cap blend and growth funds, both in terms of active and passive exposure in the US. Again, this is consistent across, like I mentioned, ETFs and active flows. We've also seen Chinese equities get a bit of a rally. So we've seen strong sort of flows into larger cap funds, again, off a very low base. So I think just in terms of, if you look at expectations, I think if you look at US valuations remaining elevated and the longer term picture for, I suppose, interest rates remaining unclear, you're likely to see, I suppose, parts of the emerging market complex continue to attract some flows. It's debatable how sticky that money is. And we've seen that a bit this month with South Africa and China initially attracting good flows and those flows sort of, moving slightly in the opposite direction towards the end of the month. And then in the US, again, some good pockets of value. We're seeing money sort of, move into things like healthcare staples and financials, again, not in size. But we do think these are parts of the market which are attractive, as well as small and mid caps. So I think, you know, to sum up, we do think that US tech remains expensive, but across emerging markets, one or two really good opportunities and differentiated exposure in the US to things like financials and staples would allow you to position portfolios quite well.
Sean, China is the world's second largest economy after the US and also has some tech companies that were former market darlings, but which are now being shunned by many money managers. Has the time come for asset allocators to re-evaluate their views on China? And should they only buy into the country because prices are so low? Or what are some of the reigning risks that they will need compensation for?
Yeah, Ruan, that's a great question. I think if you look at China today, China is either a really good investment opportunity or it's completely uninvestable. And I think it's either one of those two almost extremes. So I think if you look at China from our perspective, we think it's priced on the cheap side of what we think is fair. There are some really good companies in China with leading market shares and really well-established business models. So if you look at valuations on higher quality companies like Alibaba or Tencent or Meituan, they are extremely cheap and very attractively priced. The growth runway for those companies is probably a bit flatter than it was 10 years ago, but it's a massive local market. You know, so China can largely trade, I suppose, in the domestic space, but those companies just have such good economics. So I think, you know, government regulation hasn't been all bad. I think the focus really has been on clamping down on sectors, which under their common prosperity framework, they believe should be more controlled by government. So if you think back a couple of years, to the clampdown on education and edtech, they really signaled that public goods or services would not be privatized. So I think, you know, that was really the direction of travel. We are also starting to see that the news flow around China is, you know, somewhat skewed. If you look at things like, for example, gaming license approvals, we've actually seen those being increased. So there are positive developments in China. And I think the other thing that we're mindful of at this stage is that it takes a while for that positive information to be disseminated and to be priced into these companies. So the way we're thinking about China is largely through a portfolio lens. What we want to be doing is making sure we have considered exposure, because when these companies and China does catch a bid, we want to make sure that client portfolios are positioned that way. That being said, there are very tangible risks. Again, the property market is in pretty deep distress. And it's highly unlikely the government will bail out the whole sector. So I think we'll continue to see stimulus and support, you know, where public interest is especially important. But again, the way that we would really mitigate this risk around China, and I suppose more things going wrong than potentially will going wrong, is really to consider the allocations in portfolios and making sure that it's sized appropriately.
Sean, our conversation up to now has mainly been around equities, but where do the other asset classes fit into the bigger scheme of things? What and where do the opportunities lie in such diversification?
Yeah, everyone, so we actually had a look at these numbers, you know, fairly recently. In the US, we've seen, you know, fixed income and bond strategies gain inflows, again, largely at the expense of large cap blend and what we would consider, let's call it growth equities. And I think that makes a lot of sense. I think higher interest rates provide very attractive nominal starting yields, which, unless inflation is structurally much higher than what it's been in the past, you know, treasuries actually provide good returns for the level of risk that you're taking. And especially in an environment where the cost of capital is increasing, it's a relatively safe way to allocate capital compared to equities. The other part of the market we've actually seen tick up as well, it's been well documented, is in money market funds. So with cash rates at about 5%, it allows investors to pretty much, you know, provide some type of liquidity into their portfolio and to almost de-risk to a certain extent. So cash does provide you that buffer. Tends not to be a great place to park money for a long term, but certainly in the current environment does make sense. We've also seen some parts of the credit market starting to look, you know, quite attractive, particularly in terms of, again, your starting yields. We don't think that spreads are massively, massively cheap. But again, we are starting to see some money move into that space. And surprisingly, something like high yield credit in the US is holding up really well in an environment, you know, where prices are fairly choppy on the equity side. I think the one area of the market which does fascinate us and is piquing our interest currently is in terms of resources, and I suppose the commodity there that most people are paying attention to is gold. And I think, yeah, there's a bit of an anomaly which we're seeing. You know, gold is incredibly difficult to value. It doesn't generate cash flows. But we have seen significant price moves. So the commodity is up almost 20% year on year. And I think the price is, you know, consistently above $2,300. We haven't seen the miners really move as much. But again, the anomaly here is that, you know, while we're seeing the price rallying, ETF flows have actually been negative. So investors are actually pulling money out of gold ETFs, but we're actually seeing the price move in the opposite direction. So the price is actually increasing. And again, digging deep into these numbers, what does seem to be driving that demand and pushing the price is mostly demand from central banks. And here again, China is playing a particularly prominent role in terms of increasing inventories. So that's going to be something which is very important and probably worth paying attention to over the next couple of months, particularly heading into a US election season.
Sean, let's shift our attention to the local market. What do all the numbers and nuances that we've just run through mean for the JSE and the domestic market? And what should we expect once we know the full outcome of this week's national election?
Yes, I think if you look at South Africa just from a pure valuation perspective, it's as cheap as it's ever been. It's trading on levels consistent with the financial crisis in 2008 and the COVID drawdowns we saw in 2020. And that's relatively consistent across the subsectors or super sectors from industrials to resources and financials. Now, I think South African banks are what we would consider safe and cheap. They trade at relatively good dividend yields and their balance sheets are particularly strong. Industrials is a bit of a catch-all bucket. But again, at the index level, Naspers is a fairly large position. And that's largely pegged to China and Tencent. Resources, again, can be looked at through the same lens. I think, you know, the big industrial spending boom that we saw in China leading up to the commodity super cycle in the mid to late 2000s, that's largely played out. So it's unlikely resources would get a bid or rally to the extent we saw there. But again, the investment case for different types of resources in South Africa is fairly nuanced. But I do think what's going to be important to watch is going to be how that Chinese market performs, because I do think South Africa is geared and leveraged to that. I think if we look at elections, you know, these things are always difficult to forecast or predict. So we spend very little time actually trying to think about, you know, what those politics would look like. I do think that South Africa has largely been priced for really bad outcomes. So I don't think, you know, that things need to be especially good. I think they just need to be a little less bad than what's already priced into the market. The interim numbers, you know, largely look like it will be some type of coalition government which will need to be put in place. And I do think, you know, depending on how that government looks, I do think it could be net positive for South Africa. But again, what we try to pay most attention to is when we're buying assets, you know, is a lot of the bad news baked in or priced in? And we do think that is the case for South African equities and South African bonds. So almost, I wouldn't say agnostic of the outcome of the election, but I do think that a lot of the net bad or net negative news has already been priced in.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. And thank you, Sean, for joining us again and being part of our inaugural episode of the Mind Over Markets with Morningstar series. We look forward to meeting with you next month for another in-depth discussion and some actionable insights. To all our Citywire South African listeners, thank you for tuning into this episode of Money, Markets and Masterminds with me, editor Ruan Joester. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a review and share it with your network. We are available on all major platforms such as Spotify, Google and Apple Podcasts. Until next time. Goodbye.